If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Whether you're a long-time listener or have just newly discovered the podcast, if you want to hear more about what's going on behind the scenes, then why not sign up for our brand new History Extra podcast newsletter? It's a fortnightly roundup that I'm putting together, highlighting some of my favourite recent episodes and giving you some tips on where you can read more on the subjects that you hear about. Just go to historyextra.com/newsletters to sign up now. Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today you'll be hearing from the Spanish-based historian, author and journalist Giles Tremlett. Giles has recently published a major new history of the International Brigades, who came from across the globe to fight fascism in the Spanish Civil War. BBC History Magazine editor Rob Attar spoke to him to find out more.
The International Brigades famously saw tens of thousands of volunteers from across the world fighting on behalf of the Republic in the Spanish Civil War. At this point, how unusual was it for international volunteers to join a conflict in a foreign country?
Well, at that stage, it was highly unusual for so many volunteers to join a conflict. There've always been volunteers in different wars for lots of different reasons, whether they're ideological or romantic or simply for making money as mercenaries. But this was an entire army, as it was called, 35,000 people from more than 80 of today's countries, all coming together in a single army, or rather in six different brigades. And that really was extraordinary at the time. And, observers at the time found it really difficult to find anything that they could compare this with. And really the only thing they could turn to was the Crusades. And I think that shows just how exceptional it was for the period.
So that's really interesting then. So why do you think this happened in this conflict then? Why were people drawn to fight in the Spanish Civil War who hadn't been drawn to fight in the various other conflicts of the 20th century?
Well, if we think about the period we're in the 20th century, the great ideologies have risen up. We have communism on one hand, we have fascism on the other, and we have everything in between. In Spain, we also had anarchism as a very, very powerful actor. And so we've really moved from the nationalism of the First World War as a motive for people to fight, to the new realm of ideologies. And ideologies, of course, are often frontierless. And I think in this case, what we saw was people from all over the world could see that in Spain, after the generals, the reactionary generals, eventually led by Francisco Franco, but supported on the ground by troops and aircraft supplied by Hitler and Mussolini, and they could see that in Spain there was actually a frontier or a front in the military term against fascism, and that is why they decided to go.
Now, the Spanish Civil War begins in 1936. At what point do the brigades become involved?
Well, the brigades themselves aren't formed until October, so that's, what, three or four months later. But even before that, in fact, from the very first day, foreign volunteers began to enlist or simply volunteer for the Republican militias. We have to remember that something extraordinary happened in July, basically in July of 1936. Basically, it was a military coup, a failed military coup, or rather a partially successful one, which provoked in turn a sort of a counter-revolution on the other side. So we had a democratic government, which is challenged by a bunch of reactionary generals backed initially by Mussolini and then also by Hitler. And then on the other side, we have the workers' organizations, the anarchists, the communists, the trade unions taking to the streets and taking control. So to begin with, we have all these varied militia units which are set up by the different political parties, by the different trades unions, and a lot of foreign volunteers appear, either people who are already in Spain or people who are travelling to Spain or people who travel very quickly to Spain to join those outfits. So there's a sort of pre-international brigades moment of several months. And then we have the Comintern steps in, Communist International steps in to help actually structure and organize this. And that is when the brigades are formed. And so essentially they're a sort of mixture of, let's say, a popular desire to take on Hitler and Mussolini and Franco as their sort of front man. And then the organizational power and the political clout too of the Communist Party in Spain and internationally.
And on that subject, how far are the international brigades being directed by the main communist power, which is obviously the Soviet Union, led by Joseph Stalin at this point?
So they're not really being directed in the sense of being receiving instructions from Moscow on what to do. Essentially, the only interference, if we want to call it that, is actually the decision to set them up. That obviously would have needed approval high up in Moscow, essentially from Stalin. But once they were set up, and again, it was Comintern people who did the work of setting them up, it was then, and it was always designed to be a popular front outfit, by which I mean a broad left-wing outfit that basically reflected the composition of the Republic itself. And so in the future, about 50% of the brigaders would be communists. But their master, if you want, was not Moscow. It was the Republican Army. It was the high command of the Republican Army. And so the sort of the common denominator is anti-fascism, which, of course, today has a slightly strange and new manifestation on the streets of Seattle and cities like that. But we're talking about the very first forms of anti-fascism as fascism itself was new and on the rise.
And could we talk a little bit, please, about the composition of the international brigades? I know they come from a wide variety of different countries, but were any sort of particularly heavy contributors to the brigades? Or were they mainly European? Were there a lot from elsewhere in the world?
Okay, so there were. So the international brigades were mainly European. If you actually rank the countries by order of contribution in numbers, France comes out top, followed by Germany, Italy, and Poland. And then all the other countries in Europe, Britain and Ireland provide about 2,500 of the 35,000 volunteers. But it then becomes very complex to try and work out who they actually are, because a huge number of those who join the brigades are actually exiles already. So we get, for example, 80% of the Poles come from France and Belgium. Many of the Italians do as well. And in fact, many of the sort of political exile communities move en masse to Spain and join the brigades. And then they mix with this other group of exiles, but who are economic exiles, in other words, economic migrants, Poles who are working in the mines in France, for example, Italians as well. And so I like to call them an army of the devout in the political sense, and the displaced in the sense that many of them are actually emigrants already, including those who come from the United States. And then there's a second layer, if you want, of volunteers, a large number of whom come from Latin America, but then also a smattering of people from all over the world. So we have volunteers from China, we have volunteers from Vietnam, we have volunteers from India, from what today would be Pakistan, from what was then Abyssinia, Ethiopia, etc., etc. So it really is an extraordinary global army. And in fact, part of the ethos deliberately was that it should be like that. And the brigades themselves were very proud of their huge international and especially their huge racial mix.
And what attitudes did the host governments have to the international brigades? Did any of the authorities try to prevent people leaving to fight in Spain?
Yes, almost everybody tried to prevent people from leaving to fight in Spain. The unfortunate thing about the Spanish Civil War is that this is actually where appeasement starts. The Western democracies, Britain, France, the United States, Holland, the Nordic countries, they all sign up to a non-intervention pact, which Russia and Germany and Italy also sign up to, which is essentially a sham because Mussolini sends 70,000 ground troops, Hitler sends the Condor Legion of the Luftwaffe, but the rest of the democratic world, shall we say, basically turns a blind eye. And then plays to the non-intervention rules, which state that people are not allowed to go and fight in Spain. And different countries have different ways of enforcing that. In Britain, it meant that people were checked on the way out, not really punished when they came back, I must say. But in other countries, like Holland, for example, you could actually have your nationality taken away from you.
Now, many of these brigaders, in fact, I guess most of these brigaders came for very idealistic reasons to fight in Spain. Did the reality of what they actually ended up doing match those expectations?
So people came with different degrees of ideology. I think one would probably have to separate out sort of three levels. One is the sort of hardcore communists. Another is what I would call the much softer communists, people who have just sort of joined the Communist Party, don't know very much about it, see it as still an ideological outfit. As one volunteer I quote says, Stalin was still a saint to us. And then you have an even larger group who are simply anti-fascists, is the only common denominator. And so they all have slightly different expectations. Yeah, so for many of the volunteers, in fact, Spain was a sort of, or Republican Spain was a sort of socialist paradise when they first got here. And Orwell describes this very well in the streets of Barcelona, how everybody has started wearing basically boiler suits as a sort of way of erasing class differences. That women are much freer, that women, in fact, are armed. There are militia women in the streets. And many people are inspired by this counter-revolution that's going on. With time, some of them will begin to see that perhaps behind the counter-revolution, things are not so pretty, that the anarchists, for example, are carrying out what we might call selective assassinations, or basically operating death squads. They're killing priests, they're killing the wealthy, they're killing some of the middle class, and that the communists can be fairly hardcore as well, but actually, I have to say, much, much better behaved. And this mainly in the first few months when the government is not in control. But overall, and this continued throughout the war, and it's something that the veterans took away with them, which is why many of them really felt that Spain was the highlight of their lives. It really did feel like a moment of immense equality. And they felt that they were fighting both in the positive sense for that and very clearly in the negative sense against something that they saw as a huge danger to the rest of Europe, which was, of course, fascism, and which their own governments, through non-intervention, were basically appeasing.
How effective would you say the international brigades were as a military force? Did they make a material difference to the balance of the conflict?
Yes, the international brigades definitely made a military difference to the balance of the conflict, certainly at the very beginning. We have to remember that in the early months of the war, the Republican army was chaotic. It was all these different militia units. And the international brigades, when they were formed, even though they were pushed into battle very quickly without much training, were a much more disciplined force. They were used as shock troops. And so right at the beginning, just in November of 1936, at the beginning, just a month after they'd been formed, there are already two brigades. That's about, let's say, 5,000 volunteers fighting to stop Franco's forces getting into Madrid. They man a zone of that was known as the University City, which is where the principal attack was coming in. And they were about a third of the front there. And that was repelled. And in fact, Franco simply didn't take Madrid during the Civil War, or rather not until the very, very end under very different circumstances. So they were very effective, almost unfortunately, in the sense that they were simply thrown in partly as cannon fodder, as sort of a human barrier to the advancing Francoist troops, and they paid a very high price for it. Certainly to begin with, they learned very quickly, but I think they were at their most effective. Not their most efficient, because they weren't that good at fighting, but in terms of making a difference, right at the beginning in November and December of 1936, perhaps into January of 1937, they really were a key part of the Republican Army.
And how were these international brigaders viewed by their Spanish colleagues, the Spanish fighters on the Republic side?
Well, the Spanish fighters generally were rather amazed when the foreigners turned up. There was this suspicion to begin with that they were actually Russians. Nobody really knew anything about them. They just marched up the Gran Vía in Madrid, the principal street in the centre of Madrid, Madrid's sort of Oxford Street. Suddenly there's this group of blonde-haired foreigners in proper-ish uniforms, looking well-armed, marching in a disciplined fashion. And people started shouting, Viva los Rusos, you know, hail the Russians. And then they slowly discovered, no, these weren't Russians. These were Germans and Italians and British and French. And then for the Republican fighters themselves, to begin with, as they were also learning as they went along, they were very impressed by the discipline of the brigaders. There was this idea in the Republican Army that you basically stopped fighting when night fell and you went home, which you could do in Madrid because the front was very close. So they became a sort of inspiration, and not just in the military sense, also in the morale sense, the idea that actually Madrid, to begin with, was not alone. And then when Franco's forces were stopped, the idea that Franco's forces could be stopped because they hadn't been up till then. They'd swept up from the south of Spain with another column coming down from the north. And then also in the wider sense, the feeling that actually this was a victory against fascism, that fascism itself could be halted. In the long term, obviously in Spain, that didn't work. But certainly they were, you know, well viewed to begin with. The only problem over the long term was that they fell within a very politicized army. They fell within the sphere of the Communist Party, and where there were tensions within Spain, within the Spanish government, within the Spanish army, between, say, socialists and communists, you know, they fell into the Communist Party of that division, which certainly didn't help the Republic.
And do we know how the international brigades were viewed by their rebel enemies? Were they treated differently, say, from Spanish soldiers when they were captured?
Yes, they were viewed very differently from the ordinary militiamen and then the soldiers of the Republican Army. They were feared, and respected by the other side, but also used in propaganda terms. This idea that they were a sort of a bunch of Russians, Slavs, and Huns descending on Spain fed into this sort of ancient idea in Spain that somehow the East, or anything to the east, was dangerous, and that goes all the way back to Spain's history as a partially Muslim country. And so they took on a sort of almost a mythological aura on the other side. So, you know, feared and respected and hated at the same time. And one of the results was that if they were captured, they were shot. It wasn't until later on in the war, when there was a chance to exchange prisoners, that happened less. But the general rule was, if you're an international brigader, if you were captured, you were immediately shot.
Now, this kind of takes me on to a subject I wanted to ask about, which is that the Spanish Civil War is known for atrocities, I think particularly on the rebel side, but there were also some on the Republican side as well. Were the international brigades involved in those at all?
Well, the international brigades were not involved in the sort of atrocities that we all think about, which are the behind-the-lines death squads, the sort of things that the anarchists were up to at the beginning of the war. Though as soon as, you know, an effective government came into being, that was basically was stopped. But then the question is, what happened when they were actually fighting? And one of the sort of most tragic thing for some volunteers was that they discovered, especially when they had their first major victory in Quinto, in Aragon, was that they were actually expected to shoot officers and even, you know, ranks as low as sergeant and corporal from the other side. And this was an immense shock to some of the more idealistic and perhaps innocent brigaders who really thought, you know, this was actually what they were fighting against, this sort of behaviour. How much that went on later on, we don't know. Possibly not that much, because in the end, the brigaders became involved in a sort of long retreat. But certainly the episode at Quintot is ghastly to read in the memoirs of the brigaders themselves, who come away feeling shocked and often ashamed of their own behaviour. Within the context of the Spanish Civil War itself, this was nothing. This was perfectly normal behaviour. The other side did it. Both sides did it. But I think for the brigaders themselves, given the fact that they were volunteers, that they were often ideologically driven and often very romantic in their sense of what the war was about, it was a deeply disturbing moment for them.
And something you mentioned a bit earlier, which would be interesting to talk about a bit more, is the role of women. Were there any women actually within the international brigades, and did any come also to accompany them?
So there were women in the international brigades, not a huge number, basically because although we remember the Spanish Civil War often for the, especially the photographs of Spanish militia women and the fact that militia women fought in the first months of the war and then continued to fight in some smaller units run by, say, the anarchists or the POM, which was the United Workers' Party that Orwell ended up fighting for. In fact, by the time the brigades were formed in October, there'd been a general call for women to step back from the front line. So that meant that when they got to the brigades, they were the positions available to them were basically clerical or as nursing or doctors and nurses. There's one exception who's very well known in the Lincoln Brigade, one of the Americans, Evelyn Hutchins, who drove a truck and an ambulance and went backwards and forwards to the front line. So mostly women were not on the front. That doesn't mean, you know, that there weren't many of them, you know, who were as ideologically devoted to the cause as the men in the front. And in fact, because often they were in the medical units, they were more likely to spend the entire war in Spain than people who went to the front and were often got wounded and sent home.
Giles, I wonder if we could discuss a couple of very famous authors who found themselves caught up in this story, which is Ernest Hemingway and George Orwell. What does your research reveal about their involvement?
Well, they're both fascinating characters who shaped in many ways through their books, through Homage to Catalunya in Orwell's case, and for Whom the Bell Tolls in Hemingway's case, who shaped the sort of the popular Western view or Anglo-Saxon view of the Spanish Civil War. In my book, I actually reveal a document that's hidden away in an archive in the United States. It's a note written by Hemingway where Hemingway explains how he himself went on a behind-the-lines mission. Hemingway was a huge Republican supporter. He'd been apolitical before the Spanish Civil War. He came to Spain, and he was always rather sort of envious of the brigaders for doing the fighting. I think he felt, you know, that they were more manly than he was. Anyway, in this note, he tells Edwin Rolfe, a former brigader and a poet, about a mission that he led behind the lines to a town that he doesn't name, where he had been sent because he knew people there to go and find out whether with a bit of suitable bombing from the air and some money, they could arrange a local uprising that could then be taken advantage of. Hemingway is very honest about it. He says, well, I came back and said, no, I don't trust them. It'd be throwing money down the drain, and says, you know, that he was told he was being a defeatist and had done a bad job. But it's fascinating because he also talks about his fear. He talks about being scared, and the word actually is pissless, being scared pissless, and about how terrible it would be to die in those circumstances. And that, of course, is the story of For Whom the Bell Tolls, which is about an American volunteer who is a guerrilla, who does go behind the lines, who gets stuck there, and by the end of the book is about to die there. So that's fascinating. It's not in any of the Hemingway biographies. It's also, I have to say, not in the International Brigade's archive. So there must be a little question mark over whether, you know, Hemingway was bigging himself up. But, you know, it's fascinating. And I've run it past a few other people, specialists who say, yes, no, that sounds quite feasible. And then George Orwell, of course, has this terrible falling out with the Republic when he's in Catalonia. He comes back from the front. We have to remember he hasn't joined the International Brigade. He's joined the POM, the Unified Marxist Workers Party, which was a sort of Trotskyist party, which, of course, the Orthodox communists hated because Trotsky was Stalin's enemy. And there's this sort of internal fight in the Republic in Barcelona in May 1937, where the anarchists and POM, that's Orwell's unit, are basically fighting it out with the rest of the Republican army, including the communists, which ends up with a victory for the government. And Orwell spends several days sitting on a rooftop guarding the headquarters of the POM, and then writes homage to Catalonia as a sort of evidence of his sort of bitterness towards communism, and to point out the inherent dangers, and correctly, in Stalinist communism, where from one day to the next you can go from being an ally and a hero to a traitor and a fascist. And amongst the documents I found in the International Brigade's archive in Moscow, which is part of the Comintern archive and is now very usefully being put online, are documents showing how Orwell is spied on, how Eileen Blair, his wife, is also spied on. She's suspected of having an affair with Orwell's direct commander, a Belgian called George Kopp. And you can actually see in these documents how they are being watched by the military intelligence department of the International Brigade. It's further proof, if you want, of what Orwell was saying. On the other hand, what you also see, I think, is how mistaken Orwell was in his analysis of what was going on. Orwell's party and the anarchists basically wanted a revolution immediately and thought this was more important than beating Franco and beating the fascists, whereas the communists were far more disciplined. They weren't looking, actually, for a revolution. They were simply looking at this stage to defeat fascism. So all that's in the book as well, including there are some strange graphs that are drawn of all these connections between these supposed spies, who include people like Arthur Koestler, Willy Brandt, the future Chancellor of West Germany, a Nobel Prize winner, and many of the writers and other people who had come over to support the Republic.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
The traditional way to view the brigades is to say, well, they fought in a war that they lost, and that therefore they are losers, they are the defeated. But I think that's a misreading of what the brigaders were actually about.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down. And learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Now, were there any equivalents to the international brigades on the rebel nationalist side? I'm not necessarily talking about the troops that were sent in by Germany and Italy, but were there actually any ideological volunteers?
There were some ideological volunteers. Specifically, there was a group of, I think, 500 or 600 Irish volunteers, which... on hearing of the atrocities against Catholic priests and nuns, was formed, went over, presented itself, led by O'Duffy, and presented itself to Franco as a sort of great support to him. In fact, it was a fairly, fairly useless outfit, which had to be sent home. But then across the Spanish Legion, which was on Franco's side, there were other groups of volunteers, and there was also a unit of Portuguese who came over the border. But in the sense of volunteers, in the proper sense, it was a much smaller number, let's say about probably 2,000 to 3,000 at the most, compared to the 35,000 who came from the brigades. But of course, if we want to add in the full number of foreigners fighting on the other side, then we have to add in Franco's Moroccan troops, 80,000, the troops that Mussolini sent, another 70, 75,000, and the Condor Legion that Hitler sent, which at any one time was probably around between 3,000 and 5,000 on the ground, but they rotated. So again, you know, the numbers, the overall numbers went up.
And I would suppose that the contribution of foreign fighters on the rebel side actually would be in the end more important than the international brigades.
Absolutely. The contribution of foreign fighters is huge. The Battle of Guadalajara, which I have to say they lose, mainly against the brigades, is fought almost entirely by Mussolini's Italian troops. The Army of Africa, which was, let's call it the Colonial Army of Spain, which was the army that Franco led, was hugely important. Without that army, the coup that turned into a civil war simply would have failed. And in fact, that army was transported across from North Africa into Spain by the Luftwaffe. It was the first major airlift of soldiers, and also they were very, very good. The Moroccan troops were extremely good, and then Mussolini and Hitler between them provided 2/3 of Franco's air force with aeroplanes and pilots, and came to dominate the skies. So in terms of foreign interference, if you want to look at it that way, that worked far more in favour of the Francoist side than the Republican side.
Now, coming on to the end of the conflict, when and why did the International Brigade's participation end?
So the International Brigade's participation ended in 1938, towards the end of what was the biggest battle in Spain, the Battle of the Ebro. The Battle of the Ebro was an attempt by the Republic to push Franco back after he'd managed to split Republican Spain in two and get all the way to the Mediterranean. By that stage, the Republic's hope was simply to hold on until the Second World War started. And the Ebro battle was one that they knew they would never win. It was simply an attempt to make the war last longer. But at the same time, they knew that they could make the war last longer if non-intervention became a reality. And by a reality, I mean basically Hitler and Mussolini pulling out their troops. By that stage, the brigades themselves had been fighting for 2 years. The flow of volunteers had stopped. The international brigades were actually mainly made up of Spanish troops by that stage. And so their numbers weren't that great. There were still about 7,000 of them left in the front line. And also the Republican Army itself had become very good. Other units were easily as good as the international brigades. And so as a sort of grand political gesture, the Spanish Republican government announced that the brigades would leave, and they were pulled out of the line and basically sent home. The tragic thing for some was that they had to fight right up until the last moment. One of the most tragic stories is to do with George Green and Nan Green, two British volunteers. George is fighting in the British battalion until the last moment. Nan is an administrator in one of the hospitals, and they're making plans to go home, to go and see their children who they'd left behind. And on the very last minute of the very last day of the very last battle, George Green is killed. And Nan Green herself discovers a few hours later that her husband dies. And then, rather remarkably, it comes to the conclusion that this death wasn't tragic. That he was such an idealist that he had, continued along what she called the right path, right until the end, and that it was simply a glorious death and the right thing to do.
And on that point, actually, how many casualties did the International Brigade suffer over the course of the war?
So the casualty numbers are quite difficult to work out. Their own figures show about 5,000, a little over 5,000, which would give us somewhere over 15%. I take that up to 20% dead, or 7,000, simply because many people disappeared, so there's a large number of people who simply disappeared. Some of them may have deserted, that's possible, but it most likely is that they were killed. Even if they were captured, they were also killed. And because in the first month, the records really didn't exist. So there's a cemetery in Madrid, for example, with lots of unmarked graves to brigaders, because they simply don't know who they are. So my estimate is that one in five died. Another one in five was seriously injured. And possibly another one in five would have been not so badly injured. So the toll was very heavy.
Now, on the surface, it would appear that with Franco's victory, the brigades had failed. But that's not quite the argument you make in your book, is it?
No, not at all. I mean, the traditional way to view the brigades is to say, well, they fought in a war. that they lost and that therefore they are losers. They are the defeated. But I think that's a misreading of what the Brigaders were actually about. Their own reading of the Spanish Civil War was that it was simply a fight against global fascism. And actually, they were doing two things. They were fighting fascism, but they were also trying to win an argument, which was that actually fascism would have to be fought with weapons and not just with words. And the Second World War proved that they were right in that argument, because suddenly everybody was an anti-fascist, but also because they all then, almost all of them, participated in the Second World War, not as the brigades, but individually in their different countries, and especially in partisan units and in the French resistance. Well, ultimately, by 1945, they have actually won. They have had a victory over global fascism. That advance has been stopped. And the sort of, let's say there's a tragic irony, which is that Spain doesn't shed the yoke of Francoism for another 30 years until 1975. But in the global sense, they had won. Fascism had been defeated. They had, you know, raised their voices back in 1936, saying this was what had to be done. Some people agreed with them. Churchill, for example, even though he didn't necessarily feel any political affinity towards them, even back then, a young conservative leader called Ted Heath was actually a big fan of the International Brigades and went out and visited them. So in the end, you know, victory was theirs, again, at a very high price, because many more of them died during the Second World War, where they played also a remarkable role in partisan and resistance units especially.
And actually, many of them went on to have very interesting lives post-World War II as well. I wonder if you could tell us about perhaps some of the most important of them.
Well, indeed. It's almost difficult to know where to start, because their post-Spanish Civil War careers were so utterly remarkable. But if we start with just with the Second World War, we find that in Yugoslavia, for example, all of Tito's partisan armies are led by brigaders, that in Italy, many of the partisan armies are also led by brigaders. There's a wonderful moment when Bernard Cox, who is one of the first British volunteers, who then goes on much later in life to become a classics professor at Yale, is parachuted in behind the lines in Italy to help organize the partisans. And his Italian isn't very good. He keeps saying words in Spanish, and eventually the partisan leader comes up to him and looks at him and goes, "You must have been in Spain." And Knox says, "Yes." And he says, "Well, me too." And then Knox says, you know, from that moment onwards, you know, everything went very smoothly between them. And then we have in the French resistance, two of the key figures, Pierre Georges, known as Colonel Fabien, who now has a metro station named after him, is actually the first person to carry out an assassination of a German officer in France, and his unit also carries out the second one. They're actually operating against de Gaulle's instructions, who didn't want any bloodletting at that stage in August 1941. So essentially, they spark that step change in the resistance movement in France. And then at the end of the war, when the Allies are approaching Paris, it's Colonel Roald Tanguy, who is the head of the French Free Forces within Paris. He orders his forces to rise, and that basically forces the Allies to come into to go into Paris. Again, there's a great irony that the first unit to go in is actually a unit of small tanks and armoured cars, all of which are driven by Spanish Republicans who had volunteered for the French army. And then when the Germans give up Paris. Roald Tanguy is there again to actually sign the rendition document. So they play a very, very important part. Another character is a brigadier called Lampredi, who is one of the three people who take Mussolini out and shoot him. It's Lampredi's Beretta pistol is used to kill Mussolini at the end of the war. And then we can go, because so many brigadiers were Jews, we can go into the camps, into Auschwitz and Buchenwald and Mauthausen. And there again, we find quite a lot of brigadiers, especially Jews, have been locked up, but also some just for political reasons. And guess who's organizing these resistance cells within the camps, which actually rise against their guards in the hours and days before liberation. And once again, it's the international brigaders. And this is, you know, what the Americans, for example, discover when they get to these camps and find that they've already sort of liberated themselves, or that the guards have run off, that the brigaders, in some cases, have stepped in. So there are many cases where they, you know, do truly remarkable things during the Second World War. And then after that, we can move into the post-war. And what we find there is that they form, especially behind the Iron Curtain, they form a kind of elite, which is available, especially a communist elite, which is available to the Russians to set up the new administrations in all the countries behind what would become the Iron Curtain. And so we find prime ministers, the first leader of East Germany, Rau, is a brigadier, and he is put in charge of what is then the Russian-occupied zone of Germany before it's actually transformed into a country. But that country will go on and have many, many ministers who are ex-brigaders. It will have many generals who are ex-brigaders. And more disturbingly, it will have many security officials who are ex-brigaders, including, I have to say, the Stasi, which was founded by a brigadier, William Seisser, and was run for most of its life by another brigadier, Mikle, who is still there when the Berlin Wall comes down. And the same thing happens in Hungary, in Czechoslovakia, to a certain degree in Poland, and especially in Yugoslavia, where there are, I think, 29 generals come out of the international brigades. Well, I don't know the exact numbers of brigadiers who are still alive by then, but there can't have been more than, say, 800 Yugoslavs, or certainly no more than 1,000. So that really is quite remarkable. And even outside the Iron Curtain zone, we find them doing remarkable things. And Britain is one of my favourite examples, because there in the 1970s, we had these two diametrically opposed characters. On the one hand, Margaret Thatcher's free markets guru, Sir Alfred Sherman. He is an international brigades veteran. And on the other hand, Jack Jones, the mighty and powerful leader of the Transport and General Workers Union, who in an opinion poll at one stage is voted the most powerful man in Britain, and they are both former brigadiers. So remarkable things happen to them afterwards, and it's really one of the unknown chapters in their lives.
And how are the brigades viewed after the Spanish Civil War, both internationally and within Spain?
So within Spain, after the war, they were viewed as something ghastly. You have to remember that Franco was in charge, and that basically, you know, he imposed his view of the world on Spain and on Spaniards as much as he could. He loved to mention the international brigaders in his speeches as proof that he had seen off what he considered to be the red menace. And there is a certain satisfaction, I think, to the brigaders themselves, to the veterans, that they were still a sort of thorn in his side for decades afterwards. In the Western world, in Western democracies, they were often viewed with suspicion, especially because some of them were communists. We get people like Alva Bessie, a Hollywood screenwriter, who is one of the Hollywood Ten, who was sent to jail by HUAC, the House on American Affairs Committee. And they are watched very carefully by the intelligence services in Britain, in the United States and elsewhere, and sometimes with good reason, because some of them actually do end up being Soviet spies. Perhaps the most famous of them all is Morris Cohen, who helps to steal the blueprints of nuclear weapons from the Los Alamos laboratory in the United States. I have to say that while they were often persecuted in the West, they were also persecuted behind the Iron Curtain, because eventually their time in Spain, in the sort of paranoid worldview of Stalinism, became a sort of a negative cross, a blot on their copybooks. And when purges and mass trials started happening in, say, Hungary and in Czechoslovakia, some of those same people who had been appointed to senior positions found themselves thrown in jail or simply put up against the wall and shot. The sort of the tragedy of all this, I think, is that for many brigaders, who many of them either were not communists to begin with, most of them, or half of them, and then many of them felt very disillusioned with communism afterwards, but they found themselves sort of shoved into this single basket. Bernard Knox, again, the Yale classics professor, who had an immensely distinguished Second World career. He'd won the Croix de Guerre in France, and he went to Yale to have his interview so that he could do a classics PhD there. And they ask him about why he's got so many medals and, you know, why he was sent behind the lines into France. And he says, well, yeah, you know, he was parachuted into France because he'd learned to speak what he called sufficiently pungent French while serving in a French-speaking brigade battalion in Spain. And at that stage, the professor who's interviewing him says, ah, well, you were a premature anti-fascist. And Knox is amazed by this expression, the idea that you can be a premature anti-fascist. He says, surely you can never be a premature anti-fascist. It's like being a premature anti-toxin or a premature anti-poison. It's, you know, something that you have to be. It's never, ever premature. And this idea that somehow they were premature anti-fascists, that they were anti-fascists before anybody should have been, in retrospect, I feel is quite remarkable and telling, and goes back essentially to the story of appeasement and to their role in that story, which is as the first people really to break against appeasement, not just in the sense of adding their voices to the debate, but in actually going to fight and sometimes to die in the name of what can only be called anti-fascism.
How are the international brigades viewed in Spain nowadays?
So today, Spain is a country that is very divided over its past, over its history. Many years ago, I wrote a book called Ghosts of Spain, which basically looked at how that division carries on into current Spain, into Spain today. And we have to remember that, you know, Franco was able to dominate the narrative, as people would say, for almost 40 years. And so we have a country that's still very divided over the Spanish Civil War. And some people still think that, and I have to say, an ever-shrinking minority, but still, you know, enough to make it a point that people will debate over, about whether Franco wasn't right to rise against essentially what was the democracy, but was a democracy that at the time was being run by left-wing parties. And so, you know, the international brigades, the debate about them falls into that. So some people look at them and think, well, you know, this was a bunch of people sent over by Stalin to impose communism on Spain. That's not right. But, you know, the Comintern connection is certainly there. I think the best way to sum it up, and the way that Spain sort of tried to find some closure on this was back in 1997 and 1996, when in Parliament they debated a special law for the international brigaders, which allowed them to take up Spanish nationality. This was an offer that was made to them at the time. And so this law was passed actually by a unanimous vote in Parliament, including the Spanish right, the democratic right at the time. And it recognized, you know, that they had fought valiantly and that they had fought in the defense of democracy. I think that's a very good last word on them. That doesn't mean they were all saints. There were 35,000 of them. No army is made up of saints, and certainly some of them made political decisions later on, or carried out a sort of Stalinist imposition on Eastern Europe that, you know, that we can't ignore. But I think the vast majority would have fitted certainly into that description. So there's another sort of darker side to the story, to a story which I think otherwise is probably really quite bright, in the sense that, you know, these are people who go to war voluntarily. They go to war with a very specific idea of what they're doing, that they are fighting fascism, that this needs to be done. And of course, they're people who are going to be proved right. 5 months after Franco declares victory, exactly 5 months, Hitler invades Poland. And suddenly everybody who wasn't an anti-fascist is an anti-fascist. And so I think, you know, they are proved right at that stage. And like I say, I think the fact that in the end, international fascism is defeated is for them ultimately a victory. And it means that their war, which lasted not 3 years in Spain and not 5 years in the Second World War, but 8 years, because it was both things together, that ultimately they can claim victory.
That was Giles Tremlett. The International Brigades, Fascism, Freedom and the Spanish Civil War is out now, published by Bloomsbury. Thanks for listening. This podcast is produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. Tune in tomorrow for the latest episode in our Princes in the Tower series.